Downloads of the show are available at Podomatic.com or the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, kids, you are listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this show is Fish Out of Agua with Michelle Carlo. Today is Tuesday, June 12, 2018. The sun is shining, our spirits are high. We kind of almost feel like we can fly. Yeah, almost like we did when we were on the edge of 17. Ooh, baby, ooh, baby, ooh. Yeah, there's a little bit of a theme to today's episode. Here we go.
Thank you.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was Stevie Nicks, the one and only Stevie Nicks, with Edge of 17 from her Belladonna album back in 1981. Oh, I just love that song. Reminds me of my well-spent youth. Well, kids, we have a fantastic guest artist for you today. Oh, I've been waiting and waiting and waiting to get this person on the air, and I'm so excited. But first, we're going to continue and open up this segment with the song that our guest artist this week handpicked for this episode. Because you can't be on the edge of 17 if you're not just a little bit running with the devil. Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. Oh, I could almost feel the hair flying in my mouth with that song. That was Van Halen with Running with the Devil from their self-titled debut album, I believe, in 1978. Wow. So we had some witchy poo stuff. We had running around, flying like a white winged dove, running with the devil. And now, kids, it's time to sit back and relax, because now it's time for my favorite part of the show. Whoa, whoa. everybody. Welcome to Fish Out of Agua's Guest Artist of the Week. Woohoo! Sitting across the table with a woman. I know every week I say that this person is my favorite, and it's always true, but this lady is a special, super-duper, killer-dilla-milla favorite. And why don't we just get to it, and I'm going to introduce to you right now the fabulous, the incandescent, the effervescent, and the persevering Cambry Cruz!
Woohoo! That's me!
Yeah, that was some introduction.
Yeah, right? The crowd goes wild.
Yeah, the crowd did go wild. So, Cambry, what up?
A lot.
God, I'm so happy that we are getting to speak together, because we've been trying to do this for like months now.
It
hasn't worked. But a lot of life has happened to both of us right now.
Yeah, in just less than a year. Or just, gosh, if you take a story arc of the last 4 years, I fit a lot in to
well,
4 years.
Yeah. Well, we will get to the past 4 years and past 40 years in a minute. But what I ask everybody at the beginning of our talk is, Cambry, and I was thinking about this before, and I couldn't friggin' figure it out. How and where did we meet?
It has to have been at either Otto's Shrunken Head or some other no-name.
Right.
It has to.
It had to be.
It has to be.
Eric Vedder had to be the conduit.
Absolutely.
Because I know your husband, Christian, from the 20th century at Surf Reality. We were both part of that whole Art Star thing together.
Yeah. And I met Eric Vedder, and he had me on one of his no-name shows that Christian came to, and I don't think
Is that how you met?
That's how... No.
Oh, that would be cool.
That's how I met Eric, was
through
No Name. He invited me to do the show. And I don't know how he came across me or whatnot, but I remember asking Christian, hey, do you know this guy? Do you think this is legit? And I love Eric, and I love the whole No Name crew.
Oh, so you had been with Christian before you did the show. You already were with
him. Yeah.
You guys have been married for like, 10 years now, 12 years?
We've been together 15 years, married 12 years this
August. Wow, congratulations. Yeah. That's awesome. Wow. So I know you, I'm going to say I know you at least a decade.
Yeah.
At least a decade.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit more. And today, I'm noticing the twang in your voice.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
For the first time?
Well, no, not
or
for the first time, but just today. I'm just really noticing it.
Yeah.
So this is going to lead to my next question. Cambry, where are you from?
I am from, Texas in general.
Okay. That's where you were born, raised, and bred?
I was born in Oklahoma, raised in South Texas in a teeny tiny town called Montgomery, which is north of Houston. Went to high school in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but then I lived for 10 years in Akron and Ohio, and then now New York for 18 years.
Wow. Well, so when did you move to New York?
2000.
Oh, okay, so you've been here almost 20 years.
Yeah.
Wow, that's cool. So was New York a place that you had always seen yourself living in when you were a child?
I was afraid to move
here. Or a teenager?
Here. I thought about moving to Chicago because it felt a little like New York City light, more manageable, more Midwestern. But I'm really glad that I went ahead and moved to New York.
Now, we actually became friends because we both wrote books, memoirs, mm-hmm. about our growing up in our different places.
Yeah.
As you could tell from my accent, there's only one place I could have grown up. So, you know, we connected and we bonded over the differences and the comparisons between both of our upbringings. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yours? And the name of your book is Burn Down the Ground.
The longer synopsis of it is that as a hearing child of deaf parents and also actually more extended deaf family, there are unique elements to a childhood where it's actually not too unlike kids whose parents speak
another language,
where they're first generation immigrants. So where you're in charge of interpreting for your parents and helping navigate two different cultures and trying to explain what humor, why there are social and cultural differences and stuff. So balancing that line, and there's always hilarity anytime anybody is talks about having deaf parents and their hearing. So there's that part of the story. And then when we lived in Texas, we also lived kind of roughshod. I don't know if that's the right word, but we camped when we first moved out there. And this is in the middle of nowhere in Texas.
And this is like in the 70s?
Late 70s. And early 80s. And we camped, and then we got a trailer. The trailer got repossessed, so we moved into a tin shed.
So y'all was poor.
My mom would take offense to that. I'm like, Mom, our trailer was repossessed.
Oh, God. Yeah. So what sparked the creativity in you? Did your family love the arts?
I don't get to talk about this very often, but the deaf culture, first of all, is very much a storytelling community where they get up and tell stories, and it's very almost theatrical.
Signing
is almost theatrical. Yeah, it is theatrical. Almost.
No, it's not almost.
Yeah. But then the culture, though, is also very much a storytelling culture. They really revel in somebody taking the floor and telling a story and really just creating almost a theatrical piece of a storytelling. So the deaf community, for sure, growing up in that community, lent itself to wanting to tell stories and being on stage, quote unquote. But then also, my mom and dad are both very funny. My brother's funny. My mom has always been an avid reader, and books were always a very big part of my childhood, and reading was always a big part. But I don't know how much is nature versus nurture, because we lived, like I said, middle of nowhere. I was left to my own devices for very long stretches of time. My parents worked in downtown Houston, which was at least an hour drive one way. And they didn't hire babysitters, of course not, you know. And then there were no kids around, really, just a few, no girls. And to keep myself busy, I wrote and directed a puppet play, whatever.
Shadow puppets?
No, like a hand...
Hand puppets.
Hand puppet show. Okay. It was like the Peanuts. I used Linus and Charlie Brown and those characters, and I made papier-mâché puppets, and I created a little theater, and I charged tickets. I had a concession stand. I made a program. But I always said I was going to be an actress when I grew up. I always was told to everyone that's what I was going to be. And I do like being on stage, but I've always loved the production side of stuff. But as a kid, I didn't know that was a job, you know? Mm. So when I look back now at that puppet show that I created, like, I was a producer. I was an entrepreneur this whole time, and I had no idea. I just thought that I wanted to perform. And, well, to perform, you have to make a show. And who's going to make a show out in the boondocks? Nobody. I guess I'll make it myself. And I remember vividly being thrilled by the idea of making a concession stand and making sure that there were tickets and there was a ticketing system.
So a concession stand that had no concessions?
No, I popped popcorn.
Oh, you popped
Kool-Aid.
But who ate this? Who came?
We had about 10 kids, I
would
say. Oh,
okay.
Yeah, I got
okay,
kids.
I thought maybe this was like your imaginary friend.
No, I made money off that
shit.
Oh,
snap. So you were a producer savant.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So did you have arts classes at school?
You know, our school, even though we were in a very rural part of town, I will say that Montgomery School District was phenomenal, and I had a really great school experience. Even being poor, and some of the other kids there are very, very rich. I have to say that my childhood experience and my school experience was really wonderful.
So as you got older, how did that go forward in high school? Did you do any theater in high school?
When we moved from Montgomery up to the Dallas-Fort Worth area, that's where I went to a much larger school. I don't know if they have the classifications in New York the way they do in Texas, where it's like 1A, 2A, 3A schools. Basically,
yeah, they don't.
It's for the purposes of competition to make sure everything's fair. If your school is a 1A, it means your population is a certain level. So 5A school is a very heavily populated school.
So it kind of keeps the playing field more even.
Exactly.
Gotcha.
Yeah. And so we went from this 1A school to 5A school, 90 people in my graduating class, maybe even less, up to, we had 666, but...
666?
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, that school, though, had a really great theater program, And it was also a very great school. I think the school systems that I had, I just either lucked out or I don't know. I really enjoyed school. School definitely was a place to help me not die. My brother is mentally ill, and that's when his mental illness really started to rear.
Oh, dear. Yeah. In the late teens, early 20s is when a lot of illnesses, textbook illnesses, start to manifest.
Yeah. And he was very paranoid, and he was doing drugs as well. So, and I'm sure that drug use was as a way of self-medicating.
But everybody was doing drugs back
then. Well, yeah, same.
Yeah.
I was.
Yeah, I was.
And so he was off doing that. My mom and dad had gotten separated, and my dad was living down the street from us. But my dad does not take rejection well. He's a classic domestic abuser, you know, if I can't have her, no one can. And so he started stalking us, and then eventually he came over and tried to kill her. And it was the summer before my senior year in high school.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and I happened to be home, and I witnessed it, and I helped break it up, and I called 911.
Thank God you were there.
Yeah. And the years later, when he tried to kill this other woman, it was basically the exact same scenario, but she was by herself, you know.
But she lived?
Yeah, she did, because the cops came and busted down the
door. Oh, wow. And, wow.
Yeah.
Lucky him that he's not a murderer. Only an attempt.
Yeah, only an attempt.
Only an attempt.
Two-time attempted, though.
So how did that affect you with you and you wanting to go on into college and getting a higher education?
That just derailed the whole thing, because at that point, it's like, how do I live? Mm. And put a roof over our heads. We go into hiding. So we're in hiding, trying to get to school and all that. I did graduate. So I finished my high school career, but I didn't even bother I don't think I ever finished one college application. And this is where I do feel like I got the shaft, and I carried a great deal of bitterness, anger,
resentment.
Yeah, resentment. Thank you. Yeah, perfect. Because how did somebody not take me by the hand and say, where are you going to college? You're summa cum laude.
Where were the counselors?
Exactly. And the thing is there were over 600 students in the school. One or two counselors, that they can't catch everyone. But then also, when you look at my grades on paper, why would they think that I'd need help?
Right, because if you were summa cum laude, they figured that you had it all together.
Yeah.
Nobody would know what was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah. I'm sure
some
of that.
So you just fell between the cracks.
I just fell through, yeah.
Ugh.
And so, and this is where, you know, my mom failed me by not helping and insisting. But she'd never gone to college. None of my family had ever gone to college. On my dad's side, his family had gone to college, but none of his aunts or my aunts or anybody, nobody ever asked if I needed help.
Wow.
Yeah.
Were you able to get to college at all?
No, I ended up going to night school to get a paralegal degree. I got an associate degree as a paralegal. Yeah.
And were you still living with your mom at the time? Were you still living in Texas?
I got married in high school.
Oh, you got married?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, so yeah, let's back up. And I said, this is where my mom failed me by not helping me get my application, but also by giving me permission. She had to give me legal permission on the legal documents to sign permission for me to get married because I was underage. The man I married, awesome dude, his name's Rob. Rob, if you're listening, you're awesome. he lives in Akron, he was in the Navy in Dallas-Fort Worth. They had a naval air station, and he built F-14 Tomcats, and Officer and a Gentleman, kind of classic, you know, helped.
Wow.
Love lifted me up where I belonged.
So as soon as you graduated college, you moved with him to Ohio?
Yeah. I think we waited another year. He was still serving out his four-year whatever service enlistment. The Desert Storm War had started. So he got out of the Navy. He did not have to go to Desert Storm. They didn't make him stay, thankfully. So he was able to get out, and we moved up to Akron, where he's from. And we found an apartment, and I got a job at a bank. And this is why I went to night school, because the bank paid for classes, you know, that pertained to your job. You mm-hmm. could get some of your money back, that kind of thing. So the bank was great in the sense that I started a 401k, I went to night school. When I got my paralegal degree, I started working in the legal department. The bank was a great place to be for a while, but then after I finally settled in, it was like, well, I want to be in theater. I want to act and do that stuff. So I started getting involved with the community theater in Akron. And that, again, was just an amazing experience. And so I just, that's where I was like, okay, but you have like one life. Let's go to New York.
So I'm going to gather that marriage didn't last too long.
No, we were married for like five and a half years.
Oh, wow.
That's significant.
That's significant.
He's a good dude. And my niece, his niece, my ex-niece-in-law, mm-hmm. she would be mad if she hears yeah. me say that, my niece, Alicia, is one of my favorite people on the planet.
But that's so awesome that you stayed friends.
His family was my family. I had no family, you know, when my family had just blown up. Who do I have? No one.
Yeah. So when you moved to New York, is that when you decided to move to New York? Or did
it took a while. For me, I always called the job at the bank my golden handcuffs.
Mm.
Yeah. Oh, I had a great job, and I was making a lot of money. I became an assistant vice president when I was 25.
What?
26.
Girl.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Over this credit quality department.
So you could have went CEO in a whole different direction.
Totally. Absolutely. They might have required me to get more schooling, but for sure.
So what happened next? How did you get out of that or segue?
I was doing really well money-wise, which was a bad thing. Like, it was really hard for me to walk away from that, especially being alone. Because I was divorced by then, and so not having a family to fall back on, the fear of living in a tin shed again will never leave. The key for me was I've got to find a way out that is so drastic and different, but also secure.
Mm-hmm.
And moving to New York without a job and everything is not secure. So I was like, you know, I just want an adventure. And so I joined the Peace Corps.
Yeah. Oh my God.
But I didn't actually go anywhere, because while I was in the midst of getting like my AIDS test and, you know, you have to get a physical, and they were going to place me in Fiji. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty exotic.
Very, right? But then there was a coup in Fiji.
Oh, wow.
When
was
this?
90 what?
It was in 1998
wow.
or 9. Yeah. And so that, I was like, that's a signal. I'm on the wrong path, and I moved to New York. And I was dating a guy, and he lived in Astoria, so I landed in Astoria, and I got a job at a law firm in Rockefeller Center. And I don't want to be too hippy-dippy here, but I love the idea that we manifest things and thoughts become things. And I do believe that you can manifest certain things. If you think about them,
mm-hmm.
write them
you
down.
You make room for them.
Purposeful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you make them as goals. And I remember as a tourist in 1998 or 99, coming to New York with my Akron theater friends and seeing 5 plays in 4 days, you know, just living it up. And I went on an adventure by myself. I walked all the way from Times Square up to the Met. Along the way, I'd stopped in Rockefeller Center in the Channel Gardens, and I was waiting for Saks Fifth Avenue to open. They opened at like 9, so it must have been just a few minutes. And I remember sitting in the Channel Gardens, so 30 Rock would have been to my left, Saks Fifth Avenue to my right. I was writing in a journal and writing a postcard, and I was like, oh my God, I would love to work right here. This is just the most beautiful spot in New York City. And the Prometheus and the ice skating rink and all that. I was like, God, if I ever moved to New York, this is where I would want to work.
And then you ended up there two and a half years later.
Exact building, 620 Fifth Avenue,
wow.
The one that I was looking at.
The force is strong with you, Jedi.
No shit, right? And for a long time, the force was very strong. If I thought it came true, from wild stuff, like just stuff that should not have been reasonable for me to imagine happening to me, writing a book and all that stuff.
So let's start getting to some of that. So where were you working again? And now I forget.
A law firm.
A law firm. Right,
yeah,
right.
We worked on intellectual property and trademark. We worked with the New York Police Department and the FDNY, trademarking their logos, which we are, it was precedent setting in that municipalities don't typically have the rights to own those trademarks because they're owned by the people.
You right.
Know? They're funded and owned by the people. But they were trademarked, and then a couple of months later, 9/11 happened. And so we were able to execute those trademarks, and we were able to prosecute people who were selling counterfeit. And it's like after 9/11 too, so it's doubly gross.
Yeah, it's doubly gross.
And then they moved to a different partnership, to a different law firm. But I hated that law firm. I just felt like I was in a law firm. I didn't feel like I was. Yeah, which I didn't like it. And so I was like,
so the culture was different.
I think it's time for me to move on, because by then I was already doing my PR and promotion work. I had always been doing that.
Okay.
I had always, from the moment I moved to New York.
That was your side hustle?
It was my big side hustle.
Who did you do it for, and how did you get into it in the first place?
When I first moved to New York, I was already doing marketing for Jose Cuervo.
How did you get to do that?
In Ohio, when I moved from Akron, from the banking jobs and stuff, and the town I moved to, Columbus, did not have a good thriving theater scene. And so I found some marketing gigs where basically go to baseball games and shoot hot dogs out of cannons, that kind of stuff. Brand ambassador, kind of that hokey language. So when I moved to New York, I was like, I'll just do that, but for Broadway and off-Broadway. And so I started marketing for shows, and then I met Christian and started dating him, my now husband.
Where did you guys meet?
At the Gershwin Hotel.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He had a show there called Portable Comedy.
I remember that show.
It was fun. It was a good show.
Oh my God.
I went to go see Todd Levin perform stand-up for the very first time. It was his very first time performing stand-up.
For reals?
Yes, for
real. Oh, my God.
And he was a blogger, and that's how we knew him, as a blogger, because blogging was new. So me and some blogging girlfriends met in person. We went to go see Todd perform. Christian was running the show. And so we got to know each other. A few weeks later, we started dating. Just dating Christian and being around those type of
right
people.
because he was also emerging onto the stand-up and acting scene at that time.
Yeah, and being around those type of people, I realized, oh, not only is it infinitely easier and cheaper to produce stand-up comedy shows. I'd been producing some off-Broadway stuff that was, you know, labor-intensive, and you've got a lot of different personalities at play behind the scenes, and then there's also union stuff you've got to deal with in theaters and blah, blah, blah. I was like, okay, not only is stand-up comedy infinitely easier, but also comedians are terrible at promoting themselves. So it became really clear to me that there was this niche that I could fill to promote stand-up comedians and produce comedy.
Huh.
Yeah.
That just seems like the next logical step.
Well,
I'm dating a comedian. I might as well start working with them. And then I could be around my boyfriend more. And it's great.
Yeah, it's 2003.
Wow.
Is when I started doing that.
Wow, that's awesome.
Oh, that's 15 years.
That's 15 years.
That's this year. 15
oh, my
years
God.
This
happy,
year.
Happy anniversary.
Thanks.
Happy anniversary. So what led you to comics?
Ochi. I had just left the law firm, and not too long after, I found out they were looking for somebody for PR and marketing. And I didn't get the job right away. I had Christian and I were planning our wedding, and our wedding and honeymoon was going to be right when their grand opening was, which obviously big conflict. And then also they had hired an outside PR firm to oversee the big launch, which most new businesses do that for the first 3 months, 6 months. Yeah, they have a short-term contract. So when I got back from the honeymoon stuff, they were like, hey, we're actually still looking for an in-house publicist. Are you still up for it? And I was like, please, yes. So that was fall of 2006. And then Ochi's Lounge came about a year later.
Yep.
Because I was like, you know, this basement space, we got to do something with this basement space. If nobody's going to do anything, do you guys mind if I do something with it?
Look at that.
I'll be in charge of it. You don't have to lift a finger. So I helped build the stage. I painted it. Bought the curtains, hung the curtains.
Yeah, you made it yours. You took nothing and you made a thing out of it, and it was a great thing.
It was a happening thing. It was a really great thing.
Yeah. One of the things that I loved about Ochi's was that it filled a void that was created when many of the performance spaces on the Lower East Side closed down in the early aughts.
Yeah.
And the place Surf Reality where Christian and I met. And so when comics came around, you know, that was like the mainstream comedy club place, but you provided the alt space
right. For
the up-and-coming people. What's filling that space now?
Well, I think it's more dispersed now.
Yes.
It's over across different boroughs now.
Yeah.
Whereas before, it always was Manhattan. Mm-hmm. There's no way that was thriving in Astoria or in Queens at all or in Brooklyn. And now there are at least a couple in each borough.
Yeah,
and I do think that that's maybe it's thinned it out a little. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not so highly focused in one
area,
the Lower East Side. Because Manhattan is really, it's kind of the, you know, cheesecake factory of the boroughs. Really.
Yes.
But it's impossible for anybody other than the big box stores to get rent, it feels
yes.
like.
So, yeah, I know.
I still have the Ochi's sign.
That's so cool. I have a picture out that I always will cherish, me with the backdrop behind me, Ochi's Lounge.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it was such a great place, and then it came crashing to an end.
Yeah, comics closed, which took Ochi's with it. I did close up Ochi's prior to comics closing.
That must have been so devastating. But was it also around the time when you started writing your book?
Yes, it was. Actually, the timing was great.
Now, what prompted you to write a book? How did you decide that you were going to take that path?
So in Ochi's Lounge, I had a couple of storytelling shows. One was with Sarah Benincasa, the Family Hour. And it really gave me a platform and also deadlines and intentions and expectations, people expecting me to be there to tell a story and stuff. So that was helpful. And it also gave me much needed stage time to get more comfortable being on stage again. But also being on stage as yourself versus acting on stage in a play,
totally different animal.
Much more nerve-wracking.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Awful.
And it's harder. Until you find who you are.
Yeah.
And when you find your voice, then nothing is easier because all you have to do is
be yourself. Isn't that wonderful?
It's crazy.
It's wonderful.
So what made you decide that writing a book was the way to go? I'm going to put my entire life story now in this book that's going to last forever.
Telling the stories on stage. I had already set out the intention to write a book, and that came out. That came about because I'd written an essay called It was like the story of my life, essentially, in 3,000 words or less. And I had written it for a contest, and I missed the deadline for the contest, so it ended up getting published on a website called Fresh Yarn. Fresh Yarn doesn't take new stories anymore, I don't think, but they do still have the website. I think you can still read the story, but. The Fresh Yarn essay got me an agent. Agent got me a book deal.
Mm.
But I feel like writing the book was very validating. So, and I know that you know what this feeling is. It gives you so much more legitimacy, and that was really important. Or especially with my dad's side of the family, as I've talked about them a couple times now, that this did happen, and you can't take it away from me.
Yep. It's a fantastic book. I remember being at your book party. I remember being in several readings with you. I remember seeing you and your mother on stage together.
Yeah, she's delightful.
Yeah, signing songs and singing songs.
In sign language.
In sign language.
Great,
just amazing.
Yeah. It was great. I am very proud of the book. I'm so happy that I did it. It took a lot out of me, and I feel like the couple years after I wrote it, I didn't have Ochi's anymore, didn't have comics anymore, and the book is in the rear view. So what is next? What do I do now with the rest of my life?
You go to Astoria and you move to Astoria and you open up a club there.
Yeah. So that's what I did. Yeah, I was like, I wanted Ochi. When I was looking back and I was like, well, what would make me happy right now? I don't want to write another book. I don't feel like I'm a writer. I just wanted to write that story.
Right. You wanted to tell that story. Yeah. And it was important for you to get that out.
Exactly. When I thought back, like, well, what would make me happy? When was I at my happiest? And it was when I had Ochi's Lounge. I want Ochi's Lounge. So that's when I kind of, again, manifesting.
So this is this, so out. This is 2013 when you're thinking about this.
Early 2014. So talk about manifesting. Check this out. Christian and I have a cabin upstate. There was a church for sale up there that was gorgeous and had a 4-bedroom parsonage house next to it. The whole thing, the 4-bedroom house, completely livable. You could move in right now and not have to do anything. It wouldn't be like fancy or anything, but you could absolutely rent it out right now or live in it yourself. And the church and everything, they were asking like $85,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It was freakishly low.
Wow.
And the realtor...
Was it haunted?
No. And the realtor was like, honestly, offer them anything, they'll take it. Yeah. It was crazy.
Wow.
And so we were really... I was like, well, let's think about this and how can I do this? I could have a theater in the church and then we could have the parsonage while we're getting the church up to snuff to have to make into a theater and a kitchen and all that. I could either rent out the parsonage to help offset costs or make that a bed and breakfast. Or let's say Lisa Lampanelli is going to headline the church and then I put her up in the house. I just started getting really excited about it. But at the end of the day, it's in Sullivan County, which is it's a sleepy part of the Catskills. And I don't know that the Catskills is ready to make their rebound in that regard yet. And I was like, God bless, if we could just find a little space, just nothing too big, just a little space like on this block, you know, far enough from our apartment, but not too far, like on this block, like this little space right here. So we were walking along, and I was like that little place, that's a good size. And then the next day, there was a for rent sign on that space. And I was like, holy crap, if that's not a sign, I don't know what is. So I called, it turned out that space wasn't right and everything, but it was just enough of the universe saying you're on the right path that I started legitimately looking and found the space on 23rd where QED is.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And QED opened up at the end of 2014. I did one of the first shows at QED, full disclosure, and it's just blossomed. It's the space to be,
yeah.
The space and the place to be. How many classes do you offer? How many shows do you do every?
Over 100 events a month. And the first year and a half, 2 years, were the hardest years of my life. That's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life. It was, I'm surprised that I survived it. It was exhausting. The amount of work, 120 hours a week, maybe more. And people are like, oh, there's not that. No, there's no way. Yes, there's a way. And it's not fun. Yeah. It's awful. It was no sleep. And my sleep was peppered with fear, like nightmares and worry and anxiety. And so I'd wake up with making lists and go to bed with the lists going through my head, and it was a tremendous undertaking. Christian, of course, was very helpful, but I oversaw everything from the licensing to the construction, and I put in the ceiling myself. I painted the walls.
And I remember you sending out emails saying, here's a list of foods we could offer. Please check off what you think you might like to see us all eat.
It was really exciting, but exhausting.
It nearly killed you.
It nearly killed me.
As opposed to the other thing that could have killed
you.
So
it just started feeling like I was getting normal hours. I was just starting to get days off, starting to get time away where I wasn't there every single night, or every day, and that's when I got diagnosed with breast cancer. So it was like, oh,
boy.
Yeah, and that, thankfully, knock on wood, in the rear view, it was cancer light in that I found it very early. I found it myself. I found it early enough, but I do have this other thing that makes me at higher risk. So it's something I'm going to have to monitor and live with for the rest of my life.
So you went through treatment, and now you're clean, and there's a watchful piece?
My next book will be How to Get and Beat Cancer in 8 months or less.
Did you visualize beating the cancer as well? Were you intentional for that?
I have not. That's where I feel like I got out of practice with manifesting things. QED was so overwhelming.
And if anyone ever says you manifested cancer, you sick me on
I feel like I was so busy, and just day-to-day tasks at QED were so overwhelming that I wasn't able to be intentional or manifest anything. And so this last, having gotten, the best thing about breast cancer was it made me take time off away from work and call on people to help. And so I was able to take from my surgery date to the end of the year, I was away a lot. And I kind of regained some of myself as a result. And then I went through radiation and everything, and I finished up treatment in the beginning of this year. And with each day away from treatment, the more I started to feel like myself. And I feel really strong and good. And
yeah. You look fantastic.
Thank you.
You know, listening to you, I totally forget what an amazing storyteller you are. I mean, in light of all the other things that you've done with your life, well, hopefully we'll be hearing something from you really soon, because people say a little birdie told them, but this is the Fish Out of Agua show, so it's a little Pascal says that you have something to read for us.
I do.
And this is from Burn Down the Ground?
Yes, it is.
Fantastic. All right. Cambry Cruz with an awesome excerpt from her awesome memoir, Burn Down the Ground.
Mom said I came out of the womb with the microphone in my hand. You weren't even 2 years old, but you were already talking, using sign language, told everyone you were going to be a big movie star when you grew up. But aside from the puppet shows I wrote, directed, and quote-unquote performed for the King Boys, our neighbors, only one acting opportunity had presented itself during our time in the backwoods of Boar's Head. I was only 8 years old, and Mom informed me that we were headed to an audition. I had no idea what play I was reading for or what getting the part might entail, but I was ready for the exciting challenge as Mom drove us in the Chevy to a community theater in Conroe. I had already had the lead in my second grade school pageant in Houston, and performed in and directed a fellow third grade girls in a brilliant rendition of Silent Night in Montgomery. Mom had never been cast in anything in her whole life, but I still listened to her advice. Remember to speak loud and clear. Well, that would be a cinch. I had to do that around deaf people all the time. And as a coda, I could express myself in ways other kids couldn't. A hearing person expresses feelings by changing tone and intensity of his voice, just as slight variations in pitch and volume of one's voice convey information in spoken language. Fluent speakers of ASL can pick up small differences in a sign's duration, range of motion, and the signer's body language. It was normal for me to use body language and facial expressions to convey meaning and feelings in my signing with my two deaf parents and other deaf friends and family. The problem was that I hadn't learned how to drop those communication traits when socializing and going to school with people who could hear. So my animated speaking had become my unique accent. Once inside the theater, I took my place at the center of a wide circle of auditioning actors. When it was my turn to read the script, I read, or I should say shouted, the lines with exaggerated facial expressions and wild arm gestures. I have made up my mind now to lead a different life from other girls, and later on, different from ordinary housewives. My start has been so full of interest, and that is the sole reason why I have to laugh at the humorous side of the most dangerous moments. With frantic motions, the director waved for me to stop. Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, Cambry, she cleared her throat and bit her upper lip to suppress bubbling laughter. You enunciate very well, and you certainly can project. Glancing around the room, I noticed the other actors were exchanging astonished glances, covering their mouths and snickering. I wasn't sure what was so funny. I spoke loudly and clearly, just like Mama had instructed, and the director had agreed. I'd nailed it, right? If I'd been reading for Annie, I may have booked the gig. Unfortunately, I had been auditioning for the role of Anne Frank. What on earth had my mother been thinking? I could have acted better than Jodie Foster, but it wouldn't have mattered. My Aryan looks, golden hair, and Texas twang were more like the Hitler Youth instead of a Jewish girl trying to survive the Holocaust. My mother was undaunted by the rejection and gave me a pep talk during the ride home. It's just one audition, Cambry. Some actors have to go on hundreds before they ever get a part. Let this be a lesson. You can't hit if you don't swing.
Oh, my God. Did you see me trying not to laugh? So, where can someone buy Burn Down the Ground?
Well, it's out of print for the hardcover, but it's still, the e-book is still available.
Fantastic. And
yeah,
can one purchase it at QED?
Oh, yeah. We only have a few copies left.
Oh, so run on down.
Yeah.
Run on down to QED. Well,
yeah.
You can also get Fish Out of Agra, by the way.
Yes, you can. Yes. Absolutely. We have a couple of copies here.
Woohoo! Run on down. So what is next for QED? And more importantly, what is next for you?
For me, hopefully, is me staging the Burn Down the Ground solo show adaptation. I had staged it once for SoloCom a couple years ago, right when the book had come out. And I had gotten really sick during the run. And so when the run was over, I was just happy to have it in the rear view. And I kind of let it wither, which I'm kicking myself that I did that. I should have. My intent was to develop it and take it on the road, enter it into festivals. And I'd like to do that. Yeah. And then for QED, it's the same old, hopefully, knock on wood for another.
And just keep continuing.
Yeah, exactly.
Keep continuing.
Yeah, yeah.
Keep continuing.
Chug, yeah.
And like hit the lottery so you can buy the building.
Yeah, right. And then amazing.
Yeah,
holy shit.
We want to talk about manifest. Yes. So how can people find QED and you?
I am at Cambry, Kambri. On Twitter and Facebook and everything. I'm the only Cambry Crews out there. There are a bunch of Cambrys now, but I'm the oldest.
You're the original.
I am.
Cambry
version one.
Cambry version one.
And then for QED, we're QED Astoria on all social media and QEDAstoria.com. So, yeah.
So when we get to the end of our time together, there's one question that I ask everybody. How would you encourage or inspire a young person who desperately wants to manifest something more to their life that people seem to think they have the right to want to manifest, but this child seems to have everything stacked against them?
Yeah.
What would you tell this child?
When the odds are stacked against you, it's hard to see that you have any possibilities. But I would say there's power in your choices. There's so many things that are out of your control when you're a kid, who your parents are, where you live, how much money you guys have or whatever. But you have all the control on who your friends are, what books you read, how you spend your free time. I know it sounds like an old mom kind of like, you know, make sure to do your homework. But in all sincerity, that's where you can control your destiny. And then from a practical standpoint, and this is for adults and kids, making lists and writing down goals is tremendous. There's tremendous power in that.
Well, thank you for speaking your truth. Thank you for being on Fish Out of Agra. And I guess it's time for one of my favorite parts of the show, Hug on the Air!
Yeah.
Woo! We always end with a hug on the air. Woohoo!
There was a time when men were kind, when their voices were soft, and their words inviting. There was a time when love was blind, and the world was a song, and the song was exciting. There was a time it all went wrong. Thank you. when hope was high and life worth living. I dreamed that love would never die. I dreamed that God would be forgiving. Then I was young and unafraid. When dreams were made and used and wasted, there was no ransom to be paid. No song unsung, no wine untasted. But the tigers come at night with their voices soft as thunder.
And we're back with Fish Out of Agua on Radio Free Brooklyn. That was Patti LuPone from the original cast recording of Les Mis from 1985. And oh my God, this show has totally gotten away from us. That's our show, kids. If you'd like to make a one-time donation, a monthly pledge to support living artists, please just go to radiofreebrooklyn.org/donate. You could donate as little as a dollar, and every cent helps us continue to stay on the air. And we're going to close with a couple of seconds of the last song Kevin picked for this episode. It's by Fleetwood Mac. It's also called Dreams. It's from their Rumors album in 1978. Stay tuned, please, for Brooklyn Bandstand next, and we'll see you next week. Woohoo!